Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm such an olfactory newbie. It's just been, it's a great honor to be around all you guys and be absorbing so much information. And this is going to be a very different kind of talk. One could call it a faith-based talk. What if, and then, so I don't even think I'll use the word speculation, because the whole thing's going to be speculation, so mostly will be. But, so I will start with a fearsome ally, John Tukey, who said, far better an approximate solution to the right question than an exact answer to the wrong question, which can always be made more precise. And I think, actually, that's where we stand. We need the question of how the olfactory system works and codes stimuli is too important to be left to a single hypothesis. We need a lot of hypotheses. So that's what I am going to propose today. And my
part addresses the very first part, not the middle part, right?
I agree. His grammar is improving.
He was a statistician, not a...
Right. Again, following his seems a bit far better and approximately correct.
he also said...
No, I can tell. Exactly. It's going to be a long talk. Okay, but what I really want, the goal of my talk is when you leave here at 11, I want you to be thinking differently about gradients and what, how beautiful and interesting and they can be and how complex they can be and what you can do with them. Think of gradients as Legos that you can build great cognitive representations with. That's really what I want to, what I've been thinking about for a long time. And for olfaction, it's particularly important because basically, you know, we are a bunch of fish brains. We evolved underwater. Our brain, the vertebrate brain, the whole archetypal brain was complete before we left the water. We really haven't added much, a little bit of neocortex, but not much else. And what we know about an underwater world is that it's defined by chemicals. And chemicals, of course, are the first sensory modality that evolved and found in single-celled organisms, bacteria, everything. It's universal. It's found across all living animals and plants. Of course, plants communicate with chemical signals as well. But underwater, it's the only sense that you can use to remotely map, to detect things at a distance. Vision doesn't work. There's really a tactile sense is too short range. It's really olfaction, chemical signals that are extended gradients. If you can map them and represent them, then you actually can map something underwater. And that's where, again, I do. The brain evolved. It's also not only was it so important back then, but it's still important now. As you all know, the largest gene families in all animals are the olfactory receptors, and so that suggests that there's still selection to put an enormous amount of energy into this system, regardless of species.
Slightly off topic, but presumably echolocation would also count as a pretty good remote tool, and yet it's very rare among aquatic creatures.
I'm going to talk about that. Sonar is very common, and it's only found in mammals secondarily have gone back to the water and can't use their olfactory system. So as someone, I just heard this great quote, sharks predated dinosaurs. Sharks were there before dinosaurs. The dinosaurs came and left. The sharks are still there. The sharks are still here. No one has ever beat the shark at the game. No one's ever been able to basically move into that niche. And because the shark is an incredible, you know, olfactory predator. But mammals had a really tough time when they moved back to the water because they couldn't use their nose. Which is why they ended up with sonar. Okay, so what do I mean by spatial orientation? There's many ways to cut the cake, but grossly, egocentric and allocentric is a good way to start. So egocentric is when you are memorizing a reaction response to an object or a stimulus. For example, a beacon, the ocean, something you can see from a distance, or a tall mountain. You could move towards that mountain very efficiently, but all you would have done is memorize a stimulus-response relationship. Likewise, a mouse on a radial arm maze that solves the maze with no errors by simply turning right continually has not learned, is solving it using an egocentric strategy, or a rat with a hippocampal lesion. It's unanchored to absolute space. It's kind of floating in its own little egocentric world, and because of that, there's cumulative errors. So egocentric strategies are cheap, fast, smart, but they're, you can't get cheap and flexible, and egocentric is cheap and inflexible. So the other is allocentric, where now you are an object in the landscape. You are a landmark, and so you're representing yourself in this landscape. It's anchored in absolute space. A caveat, when we think of absolute space, remember that most animals do not have paper maps, they don't have Google Maps, if they are in a space, it's because they physically have moved their body to that space. So their entire lifetime movements enclose a certain amount of space, and that is their absolute space. It's very different when you fly to Santa Barbara and have no idea what happened between the two coasts.
Are they right that we have GPS in our heads?
It's expensive, but it's resilient because once you have a map, as you know, it's very flexible. So maps were first discovered. When did this evolve? So this is Leonid Moroz's cladogram, just to remind you that there are lots of interesting animals that don't have neurons. But neurons appeared about 553 million years ago. We don't really know. But then once neurons appeared, all these metazoans have neurons. And some people think complex brains evolved many times. There's very good evidence that that's true. Other people think there was one brain, and then it degenerated to nerve nets and nets. But in any case, what we really want to know is, great, if there was nothing, and then 20 million years later, we've got 100 phyla. What happened? And this is the cognitive Big Bang. This is the Cambrian explosion. Here's the beautiful depiction of the Burgess Shale fauna. And before this 20 million years, there were basically neuronless worms living on the surface eating algae. And then suddenly, 40 million years later, we have everything. In fact, of the 100 phyla that are found in the Cambrian, we still have 75. In fact, we haven't added any new ones. So this is really a very, very important and interesting question. We've lost some of these, incredible, obviously some of these animals are never seen anything like it since.
But is Felix the snowball? The snowball what? Earth? No?
The what?
The snowball Earth.
The Cambrian explosion. What caused the Cambrian explosion?
Right. Effect? Well, this is like the Big Bang. This is like dark energy, lots of theories. My particular theory is that it was spatial olfaction. It was something, actually...
Neuron explosion or Cambrian explosion?
Cambrian explosion.
Just multicellularity?
Not multicellularity. That was there before. There were worms. They were very small animals, very tiny, and they had no armor. They had, and they basically were all vegetarians. And it went in a very short period of time to everything became a carnivore. And animals were incredibly armored. And when you look at the fossils, they all have holes in them. They've been drilled. They've been chopped. everything is, they became bigger and bigger and bigger, and there's lovely discussions of this and how once you started eating other animals, then of course you had a denser nutrients, and then that could support larger body, and you, this went right into an arms race of animals eating each other. And of course, if you're eating each other, then you have to start armoring, and so everyone became either armored or living in burrows with protecting themselves that way. But what frustrating thing about the Cambrian is that by the there's no resolution in the fossil record, and you can see the compound eyes in some of the these animals were as complex as found now in insects, and they have already beautiful bilateral visual systems, bilateral antennules, I guess you'd call them. They're all olfaction, you know, spatial olfaction and spatial vision is already there. So we have no resolution about how that happened. So what I've argued is that others have suggested, well, it was associative learning. Something happened with associative learning there. And my approach to the evolution of cognition is that cognition evolves for a purpose. And the purpose would have been, in my eye, to map the distribution of resources. And the reason I say that is because in animal behavior, the theory, the powerful theories that have been developed over the last 30 years to predict and understand complex behaviors, they always boil down to the spatial temporal distribution of resources. If you tell me the spatial temporal distribution of a food, I can tell you a species mating system. I can tell you it's probably its social system, and that's whether it's a bird or an insect or a frog, and that's been a very robust success in the field of animal behavior. And what it always comes down to is there's a distribution of food. That distribution of food dictates the distribution of females, because females, if you define female as the sex making the larger gamete, investing more, the females are the ones usually focused on food to make these larger gametes. Males are the parasites coming in with the small gametes. And so the distribution of males is therefore dictated by the distribution of females. So it's all this domino effect from the distribution of food. So distribution of resources is incredibly important. It's important not just then, but now. If you're an animal in the field and you want to control your reproductive success, your survival, obviously what you need to know is where are resources, how are they distributed in space and time. And that might be mates, competitors, predators, as well as food, refuges, all that. And all of that requires spatial mapping. And again, I'm arguing that the only sense that these animals had at the beginning of this explosion was the well-developed sense was chemosensory orientation. So that's why I would say that this was anyway. Later I'll show you a simple model. I think you could take very simple inputs and make a very nice map to do that job of mapping resources. Okay, so I talk about spatial orientation. What about true navigation? What about navigation? When I say navigation, what do I mean? It's not egocentric, which is just stimulus response. It's not, you can imagine an allocentric solution like memorizing a list of landmarks. Again, that would be allocentric, but that would be a route that would also not be true navigation. It's really what's going on? It's creating a novel path across untraveled space in the absence of beacons or familiar landmarks. That's a definition that we use, and it happens to be something that if this is the behavior, you will find the hippocampus is necessary for that behavior to occur. And it was first described really in 1949, this convergence of Edward Tolman at Berkeley studying the building mazes for the rat and the sunburst maze, showing that you train the rat on the left maze, and suddenly the test maze is the one on the right. And during training, there is a dim 5-watt red light bulb, but during the test, the light bulb is shifted. It's also very dim, and it's shifted. And yet the rats significantly, in 9 trials, the rats were significantly going to the correct drawing. This drawing isn't, H is actually wrong, because in the original paper he describes as being shifted 1 over, yet the rats were still going to the correct arm. And he was, in 1949, said, coined the term cognitive map and suggested that rats have mental representations of space. And at the same time, Gustav Kramer in Germany was studying the homing pigeon. And he was, homing pigeons, as you know, are, old-fashioned email. They've been bred for thousands of years to carry messages. And they're bred to be taken out to the battlefield, put a message on their leg, and they fly back to the loft, wherever the loft is. And so what Kramer started doing was, and of course they're raced for this, their ability, is doing various manipulations. He was the person who also discovered the sun compass, and so he clock shifted birds, and then released them when their sun compass told them that the sun is in the north and it was actually in the east, and therefore he would get these beautiful 90-degree deflections. And through this work, he was writing about pigeons had to have a map to be able to do this. They had to have both a sense of direction and a sense of place that was integrated to be able to solve the problems they were solving. And really, strangely, both of these men died in 1959. Tolman, after a 10-year battle with the University of California about not signing the loyalty oath, he led the fight. He was fired. He was later reinstated, and they built a building and named it after him. But he was his health suffered. He died in his late 60s. And Kramer also died in the line of duty. And really, even more tragic, he was much younger, and he was collecting rock dove chicks in a cliff in Italy with his sons, and fell and died. So anyway, that's interesting. So here we've got these two animals making maps, but of course, no one has ever been able to show anything like a pigeon, because we're working with rats in small spaces, though interesting.
Could you tell us something more about that experiment? So the block is made of...
The block is right there.
Uh-huh.
And so then the rat is released, and it's trying to go up. The stimulus response would be, oh, I go up there, egocentric, and then that's blocked. So then what is your next choice? And so you just ask, which tunnel do they choose after that?
And the stimulus comes from how?
No, it's in a room. It's in a very large room. This is actually like 2 meters across. And so they're coding location allocentrically. They know where they are in relation to all the other objects.
With vision?
With probably vision. There was some light and probably olfaction.
And the cue is olfactory?
The cue is a light, actually.
Light.
It's a light. It's a very dim light, yeah.
But can they see the light from
they
the
can
center?
See the light, yes. But the important thing is the light is shifted in the test, and yet they go to the correct spatial location. If it was just egocentric, they would have just gone to the light.
Sure.
So this is about the spatial representation rather than the sensory use, right?
Yes, exactly. Right. It's not clear, right? This is 1932 or something like that. Yeah.
And they remove all the olfactory residues, right?
They do, because it's a different maze, right?
He
was very
strong.
So
you train them in the left maze, and then you test them on the right.
You train exactly, yeah. Right? And it's amazing that you train them very few trials, and this. There's been some controversy in the last 20 years, and Randolph Menzel actually suggested that one reason is because mazes have gotten smaller and smaller because they, you know, isomorphically it's the same problem. But I, again, we're arguing that if you're using self-motion to calculate gradients, you need a certain amount of self-motion to calibrate them. And so you can't get the same result.
But how does that imply that it has a map? Because it could just be that it tracks the light, so it doesn't know where he is. I mean,
well,
I believe
it, you guys know it. This is wrong. This is the goal. Actually, this was from a textbook. The light is actually there. Is not at the goal arm. So they go. If it was just going to the light, then they would just go to the light. That would just be egocentric, memorized response.
What defines the correct one?
They go to the correct.
What defines.
The correct one is the correct one is the same angle is the same location as here. So it's basically you've been forced on. You go this detour and now have you encoded this in absolute space? And actually, I mean, it's what's really interesting.
I haven't told them.
Yeah. I mean, I have forgotten.
But
people cite them freely without actually reading them. It's
amazing. Yeah, I haven't read nothing. He wrote a lot. But
the general sense of angular direction.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. But that's exactly what gradients are all about. What you're trying to map is let me it'll be obvious in the next couple of slides.
I hate to pull you further off topic, but I'm curious, do we know the London cab drivers aside, do we know if mice and rats are as good at this as humans, or even vice versa? I know some humans that can't meet your definition of true navigation.
I can't. I'm that's why I'm such a good subject in our experiments, because I know if I can't do it, then it's a good true navigation experiment. I also
tested her yesterday by showing her a map of Santa Barbara and asking, where do you live? She couldn't tell.
I mean, that's a whole other story, is sex differences, the evolution of sex differences, and I'll be talking about that, actually. And the answer is that males and females orient differently. They use different sets of cues. Females are more non-Euclidean, males are more Euclidean. There's a cultural bias that Euclidean is space, and what females do is not spatial, which is why people say, oh, men are spatial and women are not, which is not true. It's just a difference. But anyway, there's things that women can encode more accurately objects, the location of objects, and how they change rapidly over time.
But is there any clear evidence that rats are, say, better at mazes than humans?
I don't think anyone's, the things that people have done is virtual water mazes with humans, and I just don't think
most first-person video games are effectively human mazes.
Well, I think, I mean, they're different sensory, they're different sensory.
There was
that's what
abilities.
They used to do.
It's strange that there's a TV show where they actually did this thing where they asked a rat, they created a scaled-down version for a rat, and they took a London cabbie and made him go through a garden or whatnot.
Right.
I have to Google it. So there was actually
yes,
a TV
yes.
show, and he lost, the London cabbie lost.
Yeah, no,
time.
But it's apples and oranges. You're talking about a visual,
sure.
You know, and a visual versus an olfactory, you know, just, I don't think it's a good comparison. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of clear that this task can be performed without spatial map, right? Because you just need X and Y, and then you can compute where it's
like. What we call it spatial.
Well, that's what you call
spatial,
right?
You don't have like a two-dimensional representation of space.
Exhaustive representation.
You could just have two numbers, right? You don't have a map in the sense that you like something.
But how would you get those two numbers without mapping?
Well, you integrate your path, right? You go, you step in one, and Y, you add numbers, and you know.
But you can do these experiments where you break path integration. Path integration is a very short period ability. So, you know, then you
I think that's what ants do, right? So for ants, it's a trivial, it's a routine task because they run somewhere, they search for food, and then they come back.
Well, okay, and the story, there's a huge, there's a big controversy in the insect navigation world of the ant camp and bee camp. And the bee camp say insects can make cognitive maps, and the ant camp says, no, they can't, they can just do path integration. But if you look at their life history strategies and their sensory abilities, it makes sense, because ants have, they're all huge chemosensory systems, tiny, tiny visual systems, very few cataglyphus only makes 30 lifetime trips to forage, versus a honeybee, which has a huge visual system, moves over kilometers and makes, you know, hundreds of trips. I would, something like that. But it's very, very different. So ants, I think, are very, it's too bad, because they're kind of a special case, I think.
Just to make sure the special case, so the observation that Alexi mentioned, which I also know, I guess I'm curious why this isn't an example of spatial navigation, where the ants on their way to a food source can take twists and turns and do the path integration, but in a sense it seems that path integration is a prerequisite for knowing your essentially absolute position coordinates, and then the ant can make a so-called beeline, right, you know, straight back to the nest, you know, from there, so it's not a retraversal of the old path. So in what sense isn't that true, what you would call true navigation?
Mostly the way we, that kind of path integration, dead reckoning, is over a very short term. It's not something that's stored. It's not something the rat, that the ant can then tomorrow take that beeline back.
Ah, okay.
And and so it's the same thing, you know, if I turn the lights off, everyone could path integrate to the door.
Sure.
But you couldn't, you know, you don't maintain the trace. That's the main thing. Okay. And you know, so obviously you need path integration. You use path integration when you first explore to build up the map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
May I just ask like a question about the bees?
Yeah.
So they're somehow able to communicate the map. That's what I heard from reading like books about.
We've got an expert, but yeah, they communicate.
Exactly. How do they do that? Yeah. I mean, is it like enough information for them?
No, they give angle and distance. They say go this angle, go in this direction for approximately this long a distance, and look for this flower, and look for, you know, they're given a sample of the flowers. They have the odor cue in the flower. They know how good it is by how excited the worker is. They've got a lot of information. As I was saying yesterday, the highest levels of cognition are found in eusocial hymenoptera, symbolic language in bees and teaching in ants, and all those things that some of them have yet to be shown in primates. I just want to point out. I'm very
including humans. You mean
humans are, you know, special case. But what's very cool is that. Your colleagues took an Egyptian fruit bat and took them out into the desert and released them with GPS loggers and found the same behavior as has been shown in homing pigeons, where they were released, very importantly, they were released inside a crater, they couldn't see any familiar cues. I think it's 40 kilometers from roost, a place they've never been. And the GPS shows they come up, they circle, and they beeline to.
What is the target?
The targets are over here. I mean, this is, they're released there, and this is their circle, and then they're going.
They've never been here.
They've never been
here. So what are they looking for?
So I think the authors say they're looking for visual cues. They're going high up, look for visual cues. I think it's olfactory.
Have they been at the target?
What?
Have they been at the target before?
No. No, and this is true to navigation. This is when you never.
The target,
yes, they're locked. Is their roost. Their target is a roost. Sorry, I'm sorry.
So they go home. They go home.
They go home, right. They go home from a place they arrive.
I know what.
Right. And that's just like, you know, like the pigeon. Okay, so I've been thinking about cognitive maps for a long time, and in about 2003, Francois Schenck and I developed an idea about looking at taking gradients and putting them into models of the cognitive map. Because I was new to the field, coming from animal behavior, new to the field of what the hippocampus does, and I just couldn't make any sense of it. And so Francoise, who's a neuroethologist, and I got together and we said, let's make something that makes sense to us. And what makes sense to us is that there are two kinds of maps. To do this, you have to have two kinds of maps. And you need a map based on gradients, such as might be visual, or it might be slope, or it might be olfactory gradients, and that we call the Berry map. And that this is in the psych review paper, we review the evidence to argue that this is encoded primarily by the dentate gyrus in the hippocampus. And so, as you know, the hippocampus, I don't have to show a hippocampus slide, but...
Could you repeat, what is the bearing map?
Okay, so the bearing map is it's a crude low-resolution map that is encoded, we're arguing, by the dentate gyrus, and it's completely based on directional cues, which by directional we mean cues that give direction. These are slopes, gradients, polarized spaces, like the shape of this lake, for example, would be a directional cue because it's polarized. Geometry effects. A rat in a rectangular box has a directional cue because it's polarized. In a square box, it does not have a directional cue. These kinds of cues had not been really considered as could these have a special role in hippocampal coding. And if you look at the literature based on lesions, based on knockouts, based on anatomy, what we argued is that there's actually a massive output from after muscle fibers to the CA3, there's a massive bilateral output to lateral septum, which is actually place-specific. It's place-sensitive. So you have actually place sensitivity throughout this surface. So what we've actually argued against the trisynaptic, well, that there's a secondary circuit in the hippocampus that you can actually export a very crude map based on directional cues. Yeah.
So I suppose those cues are local, so that's the difference with the beacon. Like here it's just information that you're collecting at a local level and that allows you to orient. Is that like what you have in mind by bearing map?
No, the bearing map is basically is like a grid. And you make the grid. I'll show you. I've got a couple of animation that I think it'll be clear in a minute. I'm gonna show it to you in two different ways, because this is kind of the most important thing I'm going to say today, is that if you have two gradients like this and you orthogonalize them, you have a Cartesian grid. And then what you've got is XY position. And that's a very powerful way of taking a few stimuli and getting a very flexible map. And I would argue that this is, you could actually create a cognitive map. You need this for a cognitive map. So the other is the sketch map, which, again, based on anatomy and lesion data, we argued was in the CA1 subfield of Ammon's horn. And as you know, hippocampus is composed of two completely different parts, the dentate gyrus and Ammon's horn, which fit together. And the Ammon's horn is derived. It's found in mammals. There's probably a homolog in birds. There's probably something like it in reptiles and other different types of reptiles, but the dentate is clearly homologous in mammals and lizards. There's controversy, but the evidence from many very extensive studies looking at gene expression and circuitry are also suggesting the dentate gyrus is the ventral part of the bird hippocampus. So we've got something that is probably the ancestral medial pallium, the ancestral hippocampus, that is I've argued in the looking at the lizard data and the mammal data is making these grid maps based on extended cues on these extended stimuli. So in contrast, so CA1. As you know, CA1 has many more cortical connections. It's much more, it's a more modern structure. Sorry, not to offend the dentate people. No, I mean, I love the dentate. But
I also regard people who know nothing about either.
Oh, okay. So I mean, there's the old dentate that makes a grid map. This is my cartoon model. And then there's the more recently
evolved. Where is the dentate gyrus? Remind us.
It's also in the hippocampus. The hippocampus has two pieces like this.
Two different regions of the hippocampus.
There's two different. Yeah, except that they're different embryologically. They're different in all different ways. And whereas CA1 is much more, Kinecta has got all this, anyway, so the is clearly necessary for positional, for learning a sense of place. So if you want to dichotomize it, you could say the dentate gyrus makes a bearing map, which gives a sense of direction. CA1 makes sketch maps, which are give a sense of place.
And this key knowledge is obtained by lesions?
Lesions and place cells.
You can have an animal with one of these regions deleted, and it cannot perform what you call the task at this region,
right,
and vice versa.
Right, right. And then, and actually recently, so Denise Manahan-Vaughan has been looking at LTD, and she's done a double dissociative long-term depression and long-term long-term depression, and that's been really nice because it's actually, her results are predicted by our theory, because if you have a rat in a maze, the CA1 subfield, you get long-term depression only in response to small objects that are in small unique objects that are in a maze. So this is a topological problem, whereas the dentate gyrus, you only get LTD and dentate in response to large objects, but like a single cue card at the edge of the arena. Well, that's exactly what we predict from our theory. And
when does hippocampus arise in evolution? Both regions.
The hippocampus is in all vertebrates. It's in the lamprey. It's a medial pallium. It's all vertebrates have a four-part forebrain, and it's a big part of all four parts. I mean, of it's found in all. There's no vertebrate that does not have a hippocampus. Okay, so then finally.
Before you go on, several of us, I think, maybe have the same question, which is just greater clarification of bearing map versus a sketch map. So if I understand correctly, what you're basically, so any kind of map presumably can only be defined in terms of one or more objects that are within that map. Otherwise, you have nothing from which to have an absolute sense of position, right? And so is your notion of a bearing map, essentially, if you have a position plus some kind of vector, that defines a coordinate system that's extended over space, and that a sketch map essentially locates more objects within that coordinate system than the sort of founding oriented vector or something like that?
So, I mean, ontogenetically, what we are observing, and this is observed in rats, early in ontogeny, rats use distant cues, and then later they start using local cues. And so what, I mean, I'm going to have a slide, but basically when an animal, it's born and it starts doing, path integration, it starts exploring, but what it's doing also, it's seeing some big distributed cues. It might be an odor gradient, it might be a mountain, and what it's doing is making a Cartesian grid based on these. And of course, as you add more of these, you get a finer and finer resolution grid map. But the minimum is 2.
But with distant objects, it's hard to actually get a sense for absolute position. You get a sense for orientation.
Right. Well, but right. Unless the distant object is a source of an odor. And you're actually measuring, or the source of a sound, infrasound. Birds use the sound of ocean waves because they can move towards or away from sound. So there's, or magnetic fields. I mean, all those things. But the important thing is that we say that, okay, then an animal, this is its entire lifetime, and then it gets eaten by a hawk. That is the bearing map. That never changes. And one of our bold assertions is that the neurogenesis is responsible for building this permanent map that never changes. And of course, that's not very a one-way map is not a good idea. But the sketch map is now these are positional cues, and now you're learning like arrays, and maybe there's a food source there. And what we've argued is that this is a sketch map. There are multiple sketch maps. Sketch maps are ephemeral, so just as you can see, you can satiate LTP and then a rat's place cells disappear, they come, you know, they come back. So that it's NMDA dependent, dorsal CA1, where this is what most people think about when you think about hippocampal maps. There are these animal is orienting to the visual landmarks. But these can be, if you had lesion the dentate gyrus, what you would have is the memory of these objects and their relationship to each other, but you would not know where this would be, where they are in relationship to another sketch map up here that you might have explored last week and discovered this. This is my situation in the city. Here's my hotel. I go this way, I discover this neighborhood. I go this way, I could discover this neighborhood. Having a really lousy bearing map, I cannot connect the dots. Many animals can, and then if you put them here, and they're rewarded at B, they can beeline to B. So the argument then is that there's two stages. One, you make a bearing map that's permanent. Two, you kind of blink in and out these sketch maps. And three, you encode sketch map objects in the coordinates of the bearing map.
Where did the place cells of the hippocampus and the grid cells of the anterior cortex fit in the scheme?
That's grid cells are so controversial and interesting, and it's not the bearing map. Mm-hmm. I think what it is, it's kind of a working memory representation of the of knitting together the sketch map and the bearing map long enough. So that the next step is CA3 actually encodes them together. And so that's what we're arguing, that CA3 is then encoding the objects in the sketch map into the coordinate system of the bearing map. And Denise has shown that if you record from the mossy fiber projection of CA3, you get LTD in response to directional cues, and if you record from the Schaefer collateral, which is so the projection to CA1, you get LTD in response to positional cues. So it seems to have all the hallmarks of something that would be doing that. Yeah.
So you say the hippocampus is the only area which does spatial mapping, or is there any other areas known actually outside of the hippocampus?
Posterior parietal is used for, all these things have components, distance. And what is unique about hippocampus is, let me show you my little animation. This is how we make a cognitive map. First, you have these vectors, there's your home, you have a mountain, you have a river, you have another vector, there's a sun, that's another one. It's a moving vector, but you can use it if you have a sense of time. And then you can construct a grid from this. That's my idea of the bearing map. It's in the absence of unique landmarks. I think that's really important. That's what makes it so flexible, because if suddenly there's a mountain here, and you've never been here, but you've mapped this, and you can therefore extrapolate. You can go around the mountain. You can pick it up again, and you know where you are. And that so it's a lovely non-memory based. It's got some memory load, but nothing like the sketch maps. The sketch maps are all about objects and learning where they are in relationship to each other, and that means that each one has to be learned as a unique object. The angles have to all the order in which you encounter them. So beautiful Eichenbaum's work has shown hippocampus dorsal CA1 cares about the order in which objects are encountered, but to me, again, that is a signature of topology. That's what happens when you have a certain topology. You encounter objects in a certain order. So those would be sketch maps, and then you put them together, and then you can do this compute a novel shortcut to imperceptible goal, and that is what I think the hippocampus does. And of course, there's if you can lesion the hippocampus, and there's other systems like the parietal cortex will come online and come up with a really with a less flexible but a perfectly but they will get you to your goal. Or you can just do a memorize a motor turn left, turn right, turn left, a striatum based solution. But the flexibility is really in the hippocampus. And so And if you look at all of these lizard, bird, rat, and turtle, and fish, actually, the fish actually brain looks totally different. But in all of these animals, I mean, look at the size of the medial cortex, which is, this is basically dentate gyrus, and the septal nuclei, which are a very important part of the brain map. I mean, just as an anatomist, you look at the amount of real estate that is going to a structure that is found in all vertebrates, and in all these guys, if you lesion this, you get a deficit in this flexible spatial learning. Data being stronger or weaker for some, the lizard data isn't as strong as we'd like, and there's no data on amphibians, so there's just a paper just came out showing poison arrow frogs that they actually carry their eggs to places in the rainforest, and they're using spatial memory to go over long distances to go back and keep checking on their eggs. So it probably is there's a study waiting to happen to complete the vertebrate pantheon. I'm never going to get to olfaction here.
Why don't you just jump to
olfaction? Why don't I jump to olfaction? Okay, so. Yeah, right. I will jump. The next
it's actually 5 meters to the right.
I'm just trying to think. Okay, let's see if this works. Does that work? Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about the bear sketch map because when you go to these South American cities that are organized in such a chaotic manner, like Lima. My wife is from Lima. And you ask people how they move around, it's very different than any other European city because they don't have long avenues that they can refer. And when I ask them, because these cities are just monster cities, right? So how do you go from A to B? And they think about the bear map in the sense that, for A to B, first I need to go to this node of the graph, and then maybe I'll go to that node of the graph, and then I know from there I connect.
Yeah.
So they're thinking like in a graph structure, and then once they get there, they have the sketch map. Then they know the reference.
I would say all that going from known object to known object, that's sketch map. They're not using bearing map. Bearing map would be, where's the sun? Where's the mountain?
Okay.
Now I'm going to go absolutely in this direction. In fact, you bring indigenous people to the city, and they're completely lost because they are used to, because we have such a sketch map. We've designed carpenter sketch map environments for ourselves, like Tokyo, where street houses aren't even consecutive. I mean, it's everything is about memorization. Whereas if you go to the field, with these hunter-gatherers, I've talked to anthropologists who have spent an entire day in deep forest, and they take the hunters to a place they've never been, so they know they've never been in their life, and then they go for like 2 hours into deep forest, no view of the sun or the sky, and at the end of the time, they say, okay, now we're going to go back to the Jeep, and they make a beeline to the Jeep. So that has to be, that's got to be bearing map. How they're doing it,
So there are differences how people do depending on how they live, right? I guess.
Yes, exactly. No, and there's sex differences. Males tend to rely more on bearing map, females sketch, but that depends on upbringing and what their how much space they use growing up and things like. It's very plastic. It's very plastic.
For me, it's hard. I mean, coming from Europe, or
Your
cities to switch to those other cities and navigate there takes a while.
No, it's
like a completely different.
So the question is there olfactory navigation in mammals? And unbelievably, what you see in rat literature is that people are using odors as landmarks, but they're not asking is there something like a bearing map, and can they actually use it? And so recently, again, Denise's lab, they've just shown that hippocampal place fields in the dark can be controlled by four unique odors. So this is like an olfactory sketch map, and then when you rotate these four odors, then the place fields rotate. So this is the first demonstration that pure spatial control of place cells by odor. But what about real navigation? And Noam Sobel showed that humans can track like dogs. But this is really just chemotaxis. This is not navigation. And so recently we decided to test this in humans, where we have a room about this size, and this is my first olfaction experiment, be kind. We went and used the same odors you use to train tracking dogs. So we used anise and clove and birch, and we simply put a cute, like 30 drops of an odorant in that corner and that corner to create a bicoordinate grid, and we released it for about 3 minutes before the person started to orient, and we disoriented the person. So we knew that we're not using path integration, and then we brought them to a location, an arbitrary location, and then they were blindfolded and had earplugs, so they only had, and they were told, see what this area smells like. What does this area smell like? They were given 1 minute to sample. They were disoriented, brought back to the entry, and the question was, could they relocate an arbitrary location only using the olfactory their sense of smell.
Relocate what?
Relocate the place they were.
Thank you.
So so here is a picture of the room, and we simply randomly chose one of these quadrats, and the subject stood there smelling for 1 minute.
Well, how the smells?
The smells were, there were 30, we had 32 identical containers. And the smells were there and there. They're always the same place. They're always two different. We used all combinations of the three odors. There was no effect of odor on performance. There was no effect of the location of the odor. So people weren't more accurate if their random location was closer to one of the sources. They really were. So in this.
Can we forego the word random for a moment?
Okay,
because
we won't.
There is an original position.
No, we threw.
There is an original position marked by the star, right?
They have to
find the star again by olfactory cues.
That's right.
You can then do it for many positions of the star, which is what you call random.
Right.
Arbitrary.
Okay. It's arbitrary. It's not the source. It's not tracking to the source. Anyway, the short answer is it's noisy, but it worked. And to our incredible surprise, we actually were planning to do this in dogs, and it was so hard to figure out how to control the dogs, because dogs can smell exactly where they've walked. And so then my students said, they decided to try it on themselves one weekend, and it worked. And so then we decided to do it in humans. And we found that compared to a control condition where everything, they had their nose blocked and their eye and earplugs and blindfold, there was they were significantly better with the odor-only condition, having olfactory information.
What is random?
That word is not on there. But we did it on the simulation of if you just chose at random a location, what would that be? And that was higher.
What is control?
Control was no sensory input at all.
So you put them in at the start, you take them blindfolded elsewhere, and you ask them to come back to the position.
Right.
Based on what?
Based on their whatever other senses that we could not control for, six senses, whether that...
Path integration, for example.
Yes, path integration, for example.
Well, no, path integration we controlled for because we disorient them on the way to their goal and on the way back. And every 30 seconds, we would ask them to point to the entrance. And we would and we knew that they were disoriented because they couldn't point at the entrance. So we knew that we're not using path integration.
But for instance, like sound cues from the stepping of their feet and the against the different surfaces of the walls.
They were wearing all sound canceling equipment we could give them and we asked them the debriefing, and when we did it ourselves, we were not consciously using sound, and there were no if they were wearing it was a very uncontrolled room. It was open. It there could have been a temperature gradient because we had some evidence that it could have been warmer on one side of the room, but people who might have been using that, their performance wasn't that anyway.
So when you test the configuration of odors and they can find your location.
Yeah.
So when during the test, did you change the position of the odors?
No, nothing. It's very simple. They're in the room. We didn't want to open any doors and move the odors, and so we did. Yeah.
What is the p-value on that?
It's 0.49.
0.49.
Something like that. Yeah.
And you call that a result?
I call that a result.
0.049.
0.049.
When Becky saw this, actually, he said, I wouldn't have believed that was possible, but if your data were any better, I wouldn't have believed them. I said, I know, exactly. We did not
expect... experiments on you?
These are 47 subjects, male equal numbers of males and females, no sex difference. No, there's a Santa Barbara sense of direction scale that didn't affect. We couldn't have any... I mean, the sample size wasn't large enough.
So the left is females, right?
No.
The left peak, I mean. Left peak are the good ones.
No, the
really good. Doing it.
That's So what's interesting about this little tiny result is that it is, believe it or not, the first demonstration that any species can do this. This has been postulated. I skipped over the homing pigeon olfactory navigation, but this is since 1970. There has been a model that homing pigeons are orienting to gradients and odors because we know the Gustav Kramer's method of releasing a pigeon from where it's never been before, 300 kilometers from its loft, is absolutely dependent on its ability not only to smell and when it's released. But it has to have had experience with associating wind directions and odors at its home loft. So
can I go back, please? I'd really rather not. I need the drawing again. Please.
No, I really...
Just one question.
Okay, one question.
I mean, it's important. This is
no, an okay.
important experiment.
Okay.
Let's discuss
no,
it.
No, it's not.
One more back.
You know, honestly, I'm not. I'm really not. I'm sorry. I've got to keep going. No, it's.
This
I've got.
The way we've done it.
No, I. This is a faith-based talk, and I'm going to keep moving on the data. I really can't.
We'll be able to discuss this afternoon.
And because we'll be discussing this afternoon, really. Because I haven't even gotten to the big question, the big point yet. the only point of this is that you can use olfaction in this way. And it's been assumed that pigeons have a grid map of odor cues, and there's 40 years of data showing that for a pigeon to do true navigation, it requires its both experience with olfaction, and it requires to be able to return, be able to experience odors at the release point. So, what I really want to suggest here, is that we need to start thinking about olfaction in terms of navigation. And I don't think it's an accident that it has a massive connection with the hippocampus, which is so important for space. And we know that the hippocampus is, for example, the hippocampus is size is larger in different wild species. This is birds, both birds and rodents, and actually rattlesnake, that when you've got, and usually it's male, when a male is making flexible traveling, is traveling to visit females, and females keep track of which males are visiting him when and how often, and so the male is forced to use different routes because the females are blinking in and out of estrus. And in that situation, in the mating season, you see an increase in hippocampal size in voles where they have this mating system, and they have a different mating system where males don't do this. You see no difference between the sexes in hippocampus. You see the same thing in kangaroo rats. You see same thing in birds, where parasitic cowbirds, it's the female that travels like this. The male male just follows the female, and the female has the larger hippocampus. You get it's beautiful, the same pattern male in birds and mammals, and recently male rattlesnakes during the breeding season show a massive increase in hippocampal size when they're forced to make new flexible routes on their home range. So what I would like to argue is that we have to think of the olfactory system as the olfacto-hippocampal navigational system. And evidence for that would be that the size of the hippocampus increases with space use. What about the size of the olfactory bulb? And I haven't done these studies. These are studies I found in the literature that there is evidence that it been shown for many years that home range size is larger relative olfactory bulb size is larger in terrestrial carnivores, it's larger in dinosaurs, theropod species that are predatory, larger olfactory bulb. All these papers interpret this as, well, we don't understand why, but it is. It's in birds who are using less vision, nocturnal birds, it's larger. And then within pigeons, strains of pigeons bred for homing have both larger hippocampus and larger olfactory bulb.
How do you know about the dinosaurs?
Endocasts. There's so paleontologists.
Shape of the skull?
No, they just measure the olfactory bulb size in the skull, and the there's some really nice work on that. And so what I would argue is that this is a signature that it's a system that is working for navigation. And I should add that all of these studies attempt to find the ecological correlate that would explain this besides home range size, diet, anything that would seem to be related to the identification of odors. But all of these things have fallen through. But on a more massive scale, Barbara Finlay and Richard Darlington have done these huge analyses of brain size in mammals to determine, does when mammalian brains evolve, do they evolve concerted, where everything gets bigger at equally at the same rate, or mosaic, where one thing gets bigger all by itself? And I just said the hippocampus does get bigger, but the differences in what I've reported, I mean, they're like 10-20% difference. These are on the order of a difference of three times. That would be considered mosaic evolution in this model. And anyway, and they went through and looked at all of mammals, and then having done mammals, they looked at all of basal vertebrates, sharks. And what they find is they've got these simple deterministic models to explain how big is should a size of the a bit of the brain be, and 97% up to 97% of the variance is predicted from their model just based on whole brain size. And so what is the red, what the smoking gun here is that both in the shark and in all mammals, the difference. The part of the brain that cannot be predicted by deterministic models is the olfactory system. And in all these papers, they say, we don't know why it should be the olfactory system. It's not diet. These are huge species comparisons. And why would this be? And so again, I'm suggesting it's something cognitive. It's actually spatial navigation, that the size of the olfactory bulb is a proxy for how an animal is using space. That's how we should be thinking about it. We can't measure the hippocampus of a dinosaur, but we can measure the olfactory bulb. So we could perhaps make this. So what they've done is they looked at the kind of push-pull relationship between the olfactory limbic system and the isocortex, neocortex, and the limbic system. They defined it as olfactory bulb, hippocampus, amygdala, and olfactory cortex. And when you do that, and then you plot all mammals, what you get is this. Here is the limbic size of the limbic system adjusted for the rest of the brain. Here's the size of the isocortex, neocortex, again, adjusted for the rest of the brain. And you see these clusterings of animals that have low limbic, high isocortex, high, you know, et cetera, for these four groups. And again, this lovely study by Reap et al. And showing this that you've got this overall, this you do have a kind of a push-pull between the limbic system and the isocortex. So you've got like simian apes, very high, low limbic primates, and high isocortex. But again, this pattern did not make any sense to them, and they just kind of left it. So what I've suggested is that it does make sense if you think about it in terms of olfactory navigation. You can classify these four cells into four different behavioral strategies based on how they use olfaction and how they think about it. And so I would divide it first into two strategies. The first is a detector strategy. So this is an animal that simply uses olfaction to detect prey. And the second is a predictor strategy. And here, with sufficient data, this animal can not only detect prey and react to them, but they can predict the location of the next prey. They can integrate encounters to actually create a hypothesis. And this is, of course, to be more efficient in the future. And this is, of course, what smart predators need to do. And detector, predictor, I actually, after I did this, I discovered machine learning, detector, what is detect exploit. And I think this is a better one, because exploit is again, it doesn't capture what animals can really do, which is actually model and predict where the prey are going to be. And so if you're using odorants, then you're going to be increased, obviously, this limbic size. And if you're using other sensory modalities, then you should have a decreased limbic size. And if you're so you can see that if you were, for example, a mole, you're basically an olfactory detector. So you're going to have a small isocortex and a large limbic. A predictor would be something like a wolf, where you're an olfactory predator that is predicting the location of smart big brain prey like rabbits and deer, and so you also have a large isocortex. And so this is my model to explain how develop tests to test this hypothesis. But if just looking at their data, you could imagine that the shrew is using spatial olfaction, but no prediction. The non-olfactory version of that would be an echolocating bat, which has replaced spatial olfaction with spatial audition, with echolocation, because of its, actually because of respiratory constraints and other constraints. And then the wolf, which would be a spatial olfaction, and then a primate, ape, which would be spatial vision, where you've reduced limbic and increased isocortex. So I think that what I'm throwing out here is a lot of these paradoxes that are not being explained by the authors of the papers, that I think if you look through the lens of olfactory navigation, fall into place. And another one is neurogenesis. And I would argue that hippocampal neurogenesis actually co-varies not with spatial behavior, but with spatial olfaction. Because these new studies of, for example, dolphins, which are clearly very smart, very spatial, have massive temporal lobes, have tiny hippocampus and no neurogenesis, and no olfactory bulb. In fact, toothed whales are the only vertebrates with absolutely no olfactory bulbs. And across vertebrates, there's only two locations that all vertebrates have in common where they have adult neurogenesis, and that's the olfactory bulb and hippocampus. Again, to me, that's a signature that this is an integrated navigational system. And if you look at bats recently, it's echolocating bats and whales and dolphins, which, again, they're using spatial audition. They have either a smaller absent olfactory bulb or lower absent neurogenesis. But then that came out first, and then very nicely, fruit bats echolocating, which they're simple echolocators. They have clicks. It's not as sophisticated, and they have intermediate-sized olfactory bulb and intermediate neurogenesis. One more little correlation here from evolutionary history is that in the Jurassic, there were three revolutions where the olfactory bulb. You can see again from endocast, the olfactory bulb increased in size before the brain. And then this was a science paper saying, this is very interesting. Three times you had the olfactory bulb increase in size, and then the whole brain increased in size later. These are over millions of years. And again, their interpretation is, well, why did they have to discriminate so many different odors? We don't know, but they did. And I'm saying, no, I think that this is actually a signature of increased spatial movements, which is increased complex behavior, increased more sophisticated predation, all the things that would come with. We know that animals who use more space have larger brains if you look across like all mammals, for example. So it's a signal of complexity, I think. And finally, is this more general, can we take this outside of vertebrates? And again, I don't have to tell this crowd the amazing similarities between vertebrate and invertebrate olfactory systems. And it suggests that it could be that the same thing could be going on, particularly since we have spatial mapping now, true navigation in the honeybee and in crustacean. Though this is based on magnetic fields in the lab. This is based in the field using, we don't know what stimuli, but it was certainly going to be vision and olfaction. But these are Caribbean spiny lobsters. These are migratory lobsters that move over very long distances, have much longer antennules, which are used for, Mimi Cole says, sniffing, than other spiny lobsters. And so it's unlikely they're not using olfaction in some ways. In any case, both of these sans hippocampus are navigating in what we call tree navigation. So it can't be that you need a hippocampus for tree navigation. I would argue that based on the simple the simplicity of the bearing map, that these guys could be creating a bearing map and showing tree navigation with that. And Nick Straussfeld's amazing book on arthropod brains, he talks about, discusses these puzzles. Another puzzle, which I think is answered by this idea, is that the mushroom body is massive olfactory input, just like the hippocampus and from the antennal lobe. But you've got these derived insects, the water striders, which live on water, and they basically have lost their antennal lobe. And instead, they communicate seismically with water ripples. But as Straussfeld pointed out, it's very puzzling because they don't have an olfactory input, yet they've got a massive mushroom body. Again, I would say that this is equivalent of an echolocating bat, which has replaced spatial olfaction with a mechanosensory spatial sensory input, but still has a big is using a big brain to encode, to decode the signals. So, implications that I think that spatial olfaction explains a lot of these paradoxes. And I think that what the challenge I would like to throw out is that perhaps using this different lens, we could look at the circuits and the psychophysics of olfaction and ask, in what way might these be adapted for spatial encoding? And is it that just like John O'Keefe, in 1971, he put an electrode in the dorsal hippocampus of an awake-behaving rat and discovered a place cell. And before that, the place cells were not been discovered because the rats were anesthetized. And it wouldn't have known that if he hadn't had a rat walk around with an electrode in its hippocampus. And so, again, you know, how crazy can we think? So this is how crazy I can think. If what about some of these psychophysical rules that that you know better than I do? I've just read about them, about the fact that you can, depending on your training, you there's a couple of these effects. I mean, that again I got from Don Wilson's book. I hope the concentration of an odor changes, you get this step function in its percept. It suddenly smells completely different at very high concentration. So that's interesting. Another one is, depending on the training, if you've been trained on elements, you can distinguish elements of an odor mixture. But if you've been trained on an odor object, you can't distinguish elements, and you can only distinguish the odor object. And so these are interesting because they've been shown in vertebrates and invertebrates. And what if these might have a spatial function? So, for example, if you have this rule about this step function, then you immediately could create not only a bearing map, but a bearing map with little neighborhoods in it. They would actually even be more valuable. So again, this is something that is found in all animals, and it's a very simple process that would give you extremely useful computational tool for encoding space. And likewise, if you think about how two odor plumes come together, you've got, as they come together, as you know, they're going to be, and this is, obviously turbulence I've completely set aside for the afternoon, but given that you could represent that where they come together, they're going to create different ratios, different synthetic odor objects. And so in some ways, this situation, it could be perceived either as a mixture, or it could be perceived as an odor object. So if an animal is looking for odor objects, this is what it would see. Yeah.
I'd like to make a suggestion, so we have to stop in 5 minutes.
Okay.
And since you've been going on for so long without questions, maybe we wrap it up in a few minutes and then allow people to ask.
Yeah, I'm actually, I'm wrapping it up very, I've got like 2 slides left, actually. So
we have to go in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
We have to go in about 4 minutes.
So. Okay. Well, anyway, you can, the take home here is that you can get a parallel map architecture with two odorants. And so I'm suggesting that this is why the Cambrian explosion happened, because there was a very simple solution. Using olfactory navigation, you could create a flexible cognitive map of space that allowed you to become a ferocious predator, and the rest is history. So that's really the story. I think the one thing that I think I'd like to talk about this afternoon is, what do you need to know if you're going to use it to do this? What do you need? You have to map gradients. Well, you have to know your rate of locomotion, and you have to know your rate of sampling. You have to be able to decode the fluids around you, which might be your vibrissae. It might be nice to have vibrissae and respiration locked, for example. I think that's what is, I think we need to look at whisking, high whisking, as possible olfactory navigation. And finally, I've left out time. I said I'm going to be talking about time at the conference in 2 weeks. And I'd like to acknowledge Randolph Menzel, Francois Schenk, my close collaborators, and my colleagues who've helped me at Berkeley, and my wonderful students, and funding. Okay, thank you very much.
So I'm in a department that's mostly developmental neurobiology, and there, you know, there's an enormous history of gradients in neural development.
Exactly. Right.
And that was sort of, I think, quite a dominant idea, but now it's morphed into, you know, very different phases of neural development, where axon pathfinding are controlled, you know, some phases are controlled by cell adhesion interactions, some are molecularly programmed, right? I mean, so it's not so simple that it's just following a gradient. you see this as one component of this. It's not all these gradients. Which component of the navigation do you think is the most important? Sort of the beginning or the fine-tuning at the end?
You know, there is just no, we just don't know. I mean, there are no studies of gradient of animals, even invertebrates, orienting this way in the field, I mean, in the lab.
Well, in your experiment where you have human subjects, were there more errors sort of in the beginning of the process just, or at the end?
Well, we don't really, we didn't track them, we didn't have video tracking because we couldn't get a camera high enough, so we don't know. Obviously, there's an enormous amount. There's actually, probably the best work, there's a book on olfactory predators and observations of wolves hunting and tracking dogs. Now, there's three studies of the cognitive abilities of tracking dogs. I mean, there's, you know, enormous worldwide industry is training dogs for olfactory navigation, and it's basically a stepchild of olfaction.
Brian has a question.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the one difference between olfaction, let's say, and vision and auditory cues in these spatial locations is that olfaction is always going to be cued to gradients of wind.
Right.
So, for example, the picture you showed of the crossing odor, that really couldn't occur, could it?
Well, so, I mean, I think we're talking about this question of how moths adapt to sudden wind bursts. And my answer is, if you look at, I mean, you were talking about, you know, you throw an animal laminar flow and they can't orient it. I mean, they're adapted to a turbulent flow. They evolved in millions of years of decoding turbulent flows. All metazoan animals are covered with hairs and whiskers and all kinds of mechanisms to do that. The mushroom body, the mechanosensory inputs come right in with the olfactory inputs. So it's all right there to be integrated. We've got vibrissae and sniffing are also completely lit, you know, in sync. I mean, David's talk was amazing. So, I mean, all the evidence, smoking guns are all there that these things are being integrated successfully. And both the animals are doing it in the field, they're doing it in the lab, and the neural inputs are coming in together. So, I mean, what more do we, you know, we just need to start doing experiments on this.
Yes,
okay.
Glad you kicked out.